If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we start, I just would love it if you could all hit subscribe. It just keeps the podcast going and it makes it more fun for all of us when more people hear it. And please share it with your friends. So, podcast time. This week's a special one. Laid Back Luke really doesn't need any introduction. Has been in the electronic music industry for a very long time, since the mid-90s. Had multiple successes in his careers, from techno to electro house to then being one of the biggest DJs in EDM, and pretty much curating a sound that was the biggest sound in the world at that time. And when DJs became rock stars, touring the world hundreds and hundreds of nights throughout the year, just being the biggest artist in the world at one point. I am in like a DJ group, and Luke and I started talking together a couple of months ago. I met him in Miami in March, and I asked him to come on the podcast, which was great because I've always followed Luke's career, and he's always been kind of always there in the peripheries of somebody that I've always looked up to, I guess. And in 2008, his record B was one of the biggest records in the house, electro house, whatever the genre was at that time. And I played it all the time. And it's just an absolute honor to get him on the podcast. So I'm going to stop rambling. And without further ado, Laid Back Luke. Mr. Laid Back Luke, what's cooking?
Hey, what's up, Will?
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, man. Really good. Did you sort out the visa application?
Man, this was a last minute drastic move that I needed to make because my visa is running out on August 5th. And just now I saw that there's no appointments until August 22nd, which means I can't work in America for like 3 weeks.
That's crazy. Where did you, where are you trying to get an appointment?
In Amsterdam.
If you get stuck, let me know.
Okay.
I know somebody. So during COVID, obviously we were in a nightmare with our visas, and I got put in touch with a guy from Texas, a lawyer from Texas, and he ended up getting me an appointment in Monterrey in Mexico. Like, wow. Literally, there wasn't any appointments anywhere. And then he typical America, he went to, I should get him on the podcast, actually, it'd be a good conversation. He went to the school, he went to law school with the guy that runs the Monterrey embassy. So he was literally just like throwing people in. Black Coffee's manager, Chrissy, because they got him to do it for him. And yeah, absolute genius, that guy. Saved my ass.
You know what? I've heard about a bunch of DJs that went through Mexico,
yeah,
and did this. So that's interesting.
It's much easier. It was actually the easiest appointment I've ever had. And you know, sometimes you have to wait like 10 days to get your passport back. The next day they give it to you.
Oof. Whoa.
Yeah.
All right. That's great info.
It's not any more expensive. It's the same cost.
Wow.
So it's like,
wow.
And you get to spend some days in Monterrey.
Amazing.
Where are you at the moment?
I'm in New York.
Nice. Is that your home base?
Yeah, pretty much throughout the pandemic.
Nice, yes. Man. So when did you move to New York? Was it at the beginning?
Well, I actually got married about 10 years ago,
mm-hmm,
to my ex, mm-hmm, and we had a baby here. We had a baby daughter.
Yep.
And so, throughout the pandemic, before the pandemic, I would travel back and forth to the Netherlands because of my two sons in the Netherlands. Yeah. And due to the pandemic, I chose to stay in New York because my daughter, at the time was only six.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my boys are like, well, they're grown men now.
Older.
So,
amazing.
Yeah, they're very much older.
Are they in the Netherlands as well?
Yeah, so the boys are in the Netherlands. They're currently 21 and 18.
Nice.
And my daughter over here is 8. And actually, we just announced this week that my wife and I are expecting.
Oh, amazing. Congrats.
Thank you. So I just keep on producing, I
guess. Yeah, geez, man. That's going to be busy and expensive.
Yes, all of that, for sure.
How do you find living in New York?
Well, I live actually in like a more of a suburban area. Okay. So it's upstate,
nice,
we call it here. So out of the city. But if I want to be on Times Square, it's like a 25-minute drive.
Oh, really?
And so I actually enjoy the nice and quiet. Mm. And then whenever I want some madness, you can just hop into the city.
Yeah, man. I love New York. I was there a couple of weeks ago, and it's literally my favorite city in the world. I used to live in Williamsburg. And honestly, if I wasn't touring so much and I could actually enjoy living in New York because I'm actually there, I would move there tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah, man. It's my favorite place.
Well, I'm going to throw some shade into like the New York dream. And for everyone that's hearing this, and probably the New Yorkers that are tuned in can agree with me, the winters are crazy. This year, we've had, well, we're kind of still in here, 6 months of winter. Mm-hmm. I kid you not. 6 months.
I live in Detroit when I'm in America. And the winters there are brutal as well.
Yeah, that's even worse, man.
Proper brutal. It gets cold. I like winters, though. I'm a weird person. Not many people like winters, but I like the full seasons.
Oof.
Yeah, I couldn't live in... Well, I used to live in LA, and I'm just not a fan because it's just constantly fucking sunny. And you're just like, come on. It just turns you into a weak human being. Sorry to all the people from California, but yeah. I want to talk about... I've got a lot to talk about with you. I'm really intrigued into your life and your career. I kind of want to go back to where it all started to start with. I've got a lot of questions to ask you throughout it, but I'd love to find out when it started for you and how it started for you.
How it started for me was I came from a musical family. My dad plays guitar and bass. My uncle played a bit of piano. And usually when the family got together, they would form like a musical band and they would like sing songs with the whole family. Mm. I was always a bit intrigued with that. And at a certain point, I started to touch keys and whatnot. And my dad has a proud baby picture of me and him, like me as a baby holding the guitar and he's playing the guitar. And so I had a bunch of that throughout my youth. But I was the one guy in the family, so I do need to tell you that my brother, for instance, is an incredible drummer, and he drums hardcore music. So not hardcore the electronic music, but hardcore the punk music. When he drums, it's like he's moving eight limbs and it's super high BPM. I was the one guy in the family that couldn't keep a rhythm with the fingers. And I could play, but I was never like any good. Like I could barely like achieve the songs that we were playing, and I always got made fun of.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, when I was 15, a friend of mine showed me on an Amiga computer. He had Technotronics Pump Up to Jam on there in Tracker, I believe it was, and he showed me how to mute the beats or to solo out the chords. And I was like, dude, so mind you, this is 1992. And I asked him, dude, so you can use a computer to make music, like you can program the notes. And instantly I was like, man, so all of this music that has always been stuck in my head, which I couldn't perform, I can now program.
Amazing.
And this was a revelation. Yeah. I was like, man, when I found that out, I really knew that this was what I wanted to do the rest of my life. So in contrary to what a lot of people think, I actually started as a producer. And from then on, I started to produce on anything I could get my hands on, because we didn't really have a computer yet at that time. So I found out that in my dad's Casio keyboard, there was a sequencer. Mm. And so I would just try and program a drum beat, or like record a drum beat for like 3 minutes long, and then record the chords and that sort of thing. And then when my dad got the first PC, I started making music on that. But that sucked because I couldn't sample with it.
Yeah.
And it was literally the first sound card ever in that PC, and it sounded like nothing. So, yeah.
Was it the sound card that you had to put the like headphone jack in and then the speakers out of that?
Yeah, no, but it was almost as if, like we're not even talking about 8-bit sounds right now. It's like nothing remotely, because, you know, I obviously was a real big fan of house music already, and it took me a good 1.5 to 2 years to find out what a 909 hi-hat was. And I was searching all over, and my Casio keyboard didn't have it. And, you know, at a certain point, this friend of mine said, dude, you can just sample that.
Mm.
And I was like, what? What is sampling?
Yeah. What? So did you ever, because back in the 90s, it's hard to make music. It wasn't as easy and accessible as it is now. Did you ever go the hardware route where you were like started on MPCs and things like that?
Absolutely. That's actually the next chapter.
Yeah.
Because when I found out how all of these tracks were being made, I remember a glorious summer where my dad said, oh, a coworker of mine has this keyboard, like a fancy keyboard. And, you can borrow it for the summer. Like, I know you're making music and whatnot. Would you be interested? I'm like, dude, bring it over to my bedroom. And so he brought it in, and it was a massive keyboard. And it was actually the original Korg M1.
Oh, wow.
Dude, when I came across that house piano preset, and by this time, you know, we've had like Robin S and Nightcrawlers and all of that, I was like, pling, no, that's it. The only thing was that hi-hat I was looking for was not in there. But throughout the whole of that summer, I was just making tracks and demos with that thing. And I'm just thinking, did I use the MIDI out of the PC? Probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just remember my dad storming in at a certain point mid-summer, and I had just been in my bedroom for days on end, day and night. And he's like, dude, you need to get outside. And I'm like, dad, but I'm enjoying this. Like, I'm making tracks and
yeah,
sounds so awesome.
I love that. It's amazing what happens when you, like, that first feeling of when you actually get it and you're like, oh my God, I'm actually making music for the first time. And it probably sounds terrible, but it's still the best feeling ever.
Yeah, I'm so happy we're talking about this, because if we're really gonna go to like day one,
yeah,
I remember slowing down house beats because I was like, how did they program that?
Yeah.
So at a certain point, I had made it was like a very cheap little Casio keyboard mm-hmm. that I had that you could like take 2 second samples with. And I could actually slow that down. Mm. And at a certain point when slowed down, I heard, oh, wait a second, it's a closed hi-hat right in between the kick drum and the hi-hat or straight after. And I was like, when I slowed it down, it was like,
yeah.
I was like, whoa, okay, so this is it. Like my first house loop ever, I dissected it. And mind you, we did not have internet, like literally.
Yeah.
There was no internet. There was no tutorials. There was nothing. Like I had to figure it out on my own. So I did.
How did you get into the house music though? Because it's a very, how old were you then?
Yeah, 15.
So 15. What got you into the house music? Was house music in the Netherlands big then?
Well, similarly to the UK.
Yeah.
This first wave of house music taking over, coming from America, what was it, 88, 89, yeah. all of that?
Mm-hmm.
This was as big as in the Netherlands. Granted, in the UK, it went a bit ravey.
Yeah.
We were more, apart from like the whole gabber scene and hardcore scene exploding, we had like a mellow side to it, which was all... Well, I remember Little Louis' French Kiss
classic
hitting number one in the top 40 charts.
Wow.
As is in the Netherlands.
What year was that?
Well, I need to look it up.
When did that come out? I've got to find that out, because
I believe it was like 89 or something.
Was it really that early? Little Louis French Kiss release date. It came out 1989, yeah.
There you go.
A long time ago.
And so, yeah, I heard this music. I was mesmerized with it. Coming from, growing up to a lot of pop and early hip-hop, I was amazed by the energy and the tempo it had, where there was a sort of, like, energy to it, like a basic rhythm that you just wanted to dance to. And I quickly noticed that had to do with like the kick drum being just 4/4, and then the crazy synths and sounds where it was like, this doesn't sound like a piano, or this doesn't sound like a bass guitar. I mean, that sounds like an organ, but it's not an organ, you know. I know from like pop songs.
Yeah.
And this is what I loved about it for sure.
It's amazing how, when in the 90s and even to the extent like the early 2000s, when the internet wasn't as available as it is today, and how everyone had to work out how to do something in their own little way. And I feel like it's then it was even more of a passion to, it was kind of like this like secret for everybody. And when you found the secret and you kind of unlocked it, you were like, okay, I'm in for life now. And do you feel it's different? Well, of course it's different nowadays, but do you feel it kind of has taken a little bit of the value away, or do you think it's benefited the industry now of how it is?
It's just evolution. If I look at my own development, it took me a good 10 years to be able to sound remotely professional.
Same.
And nowadays kids, after 3 years, they can sound professional, and all the info that's needed is out there, and it's wonderful. I mean, you know, all of us Google things that we don't know, and it's just here, and it's so much easier. So yeah, I actually appreciate it.
No, I think it brings a lot to the industry where we, not just to the industry, to the world. The internet has made the world a smaller place, but a more knowledgeable place. Don't get me wrong, there's some bullshit in there, but there's a lot of good as well that's come out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's given us all longevity, and able to like grow in different territories and being able to, for our music to be heard in different territories that would never have been heard, like back in the 90s in the vinyl day, even early 2000s with the vinyls. Like, you're not going to be worldwide specifically. Some people are, but compared to the amount of DJs that are nowadays, it was never going to be like that.
No, and so for the people that are younger and that are listening to this, can you imagine a world without, so obviously without internet, but without social media? There was no social media, nothing. And so the only promotion you had were magazines and possibly ads in magazines.
Yeah.
And then you had the literal product. So the vinyls you put out, they would go, if you had the right distribution, they would go worldwide. And through the actual music that you released, your name would spread.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how it used to happen, to be fair. I learned on vinyl, but I my first release, it was when it was turned digital.
What year was this? Well,
my first release was 2007. I think I was 17 at the time. Yeah, it's pretty amazing how it's gone so quickly, really. I want to go back to the start, and were your parents really supportive of you?
I love that question, because the same moment that my dad waltzed into my my bedroom, where I was spending my whole summer making music on this M1 synthesizer, he said, "But why are you throwing your whole summer away to make music?" And I'm like, "Dad, this is something that I love. This is something that I want to do the rest of my life, and I want to make a living out of this." And he said, "Such nonsense. Do you know how many kids want to do this for a living? And you need to find like a real job and spend your time on something else." And I was like, "Dad, you watch me." So the door got closed and I started even making more music. And I kind of, one of my goals was to prove my dad wrong.
Yeah.
Which now we often talk about it, how immensely wrong he was. And it's been a weird one with my kids, because they have dreams, they have goals. For instance, my oldest son, he wants to be a game designer.
Amazing.
And a couple of years ago, I caught myself storming into his room saying, "Why are you spending days and nights behind the computer gaming?" And I was like, "Oh, let me back up."
Yeah.
And I closed the door. You know, it's such a tremendous industry, the gaming industry, and he wants to do this. And, you know, I can only support that. But yeah, so my dad, okay, so my dad let that be. And at a certain point, my uncle gave me his old computer. Speaking of gaming, I was gaming on his Atari ST throughout the summer. And then I found out that there was a musical program on there.
Cubase?
Cubase. Yeah. It was called Cubase. And I was like, this doesn't look like that tracker program I know, but let me figure this out. And I remember buying my first sampler, which was an Akai
2100. Was it 2100?
This was one. So it was not an MPC.
No, Akai. I used to work with one years ago. Akai 21. Was it 21 sampler? I've got to Google this. Sorry for everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it wasn't that. Yeah. S1000.
Oh, that really rings a bell.
Did it look like this?
Oh, no. Mine had keys.
Oh,
mine
really? Had you keys. Had a key? Mine,
yeah.
Damn, you were fancy.
Somewhat fancy. Fancy version.
Okay.
But, yeah, so mind you, you got, what was it? either 8 seconds or 16 seconds total sample time.
Yeah, like and 16 megabytes.
And it worked with floppy disks, yep. Right? Yep. And I had bought a sample CD, and on that sample CD were a couple of 909 hi-hat and kick drum samples.
Amazing. So you found and it eventually.
Man, when I first started to use that actual kick drum and that actual hi-hat, I felt my productions leveled up so much because all of a sudden I could sound like those real guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to give a shout-out to my mentor, Gaston. Mm-hmm. He is from Chocolate Puma.
Oh, wow. And
by that time, they were the good men. They had scored some hits and whatnot. And I found out that he was on this the same high school as myself.
Amazing.
But he had just graduated, and he was playing my my high school prom party. And I had been making music with this Atari and the sampler by now, and I had a few demos. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make a demo tape, and he's going to DJ there. So this is my shot to, like, okay, so I'm just going to go up to him and say, hi, I'm Luke. I'm from this school as well. I make music too. Here's my demo. So this actually happened, you know, super nervous. It was he played an awesome set. And there goes the demo tape.
Was that a CD? Like,
tape.
Tape, like little, actual tape. Little damn.
Cassette tape. Yep, cassette tape. And so he had the tape. And I was like, I'm in. Like, he was really nice about it. I'm in. So, I waited a good 3 weeks for a response because obviously my phone number was on the cassette tape, and no response. I was like, oh, okay. No, maybe he didn't like it, but through some mutual acquaintances, I found out his home phone number. And this is the funny thing as well, because I called it and his mom picked it up. So he was still living at his parents. And I was like, I'm Luke. I gave Gaston this demo a couple of weeks ago. I didn't hear back from him. Would you mind checking with him? Like, I would just love a response. His mom was like, okay, I'm going to do it. A few weeks go by. I don't hear anything. Call the mom again. Mom says, well, he had listened to it, but I don't know what is taking him so long to respond. A few more weeks go by. I call him again. And I'm like, by this time, I'm like, I'm just fed up with it. Like, you know, ma'am, this is my last call. After this, I won't call anymore, but I would still love a response. If this is not it, then okay, so whatever.
Yeah.
Week later, he calls me, and he's like, dude, I'm so sorry. I've been busy. By this time, he had a couple of top 40 hits and whatnot. Wow. His own record label, his own Fresh Fruit record label. And he's like, I heard the demo, and it's incredible.
Wow.
I actually hear talent in you, and even though the sounds can be better and some programming here and there, I hear massive talent in you. And I was like, oh my god, this is incredible. Can I come over and let you hear more demos, newer demos? And he's like, sure. And so we started to do that, like every month or so, every couple of months, I would go to his house. We'd listen to my demos. He'd give me advice, he'd give me producer tips, he would let me hear tracks by Carl Gregg and DJ Pierre. He was a fan of a lot of Strictly Rhythm records, Armand van Helden stuff, and he was like, this is how it should sound, and try and program this, try and EQ that. So I leveled up through that. Where at about 1.5 year later, he offered me my first record deal ever. And so at the age of 18 and 19, 95, I got my first record deal. October 1995, I put out my first vinyl.
And what was that record?
Well, we had made my own record label because he said my sound was actually very New York. I was very much inspired by MK myself.
Yeah.
Strictly Rhythm. And he's like, it should not look like anything Dutch. Should be its own record label. We're going to have it in vinyl with the little plastic in there. It's just dark and some stripes.
Yeah.
And my first ever track that came out is called Booty Twister.
Do you still play it? Do you ever play it?
You know what? I would play it in like a kind of like more of a deep house set.
Yeah.
So mind you, my first release and the tracks I was making at that time were very much MK, like Strictly Rhythm, like very, very housey.
It's amazing how, because I had MK on the podcast a couple of months ago, and it's amazing how much influence he's given to the industry over the years, and also like how much influence he gave when he wasn't actually doing it, when he'd stopped and he'd moved to hip hop and people were still referencing his records. It's kind of amazing to have. I wouldn't say there's many people in the industry that have actually done that in the past and still do it today.
You know what, I very much agree with you. And what I love about MK and his sound is that it's a timeless sound, and he doesn't even realize it. He didn't make it, you know, with that type of intention.
Yeah.
But there's a feel and vibe into his tracks where, you know, if I could be hating and saying that, you know, his tracks currently sound similar to his tracks like two decades ago. And it's really because of this timeless sound. And it's something that inspires me currently, where I'm now in a realm where I'm like, I need to make these type of timeless, like house tracks. And it doesn't necessarily need to be house or, you know, it could be commercial, could be more underground, could be more tech, could be more deep, but a sort of like a timeless. I feel that's how you make the classics.
I totally agree. I think for me also, it's about just being as authentic as possible to yourself. And I think that's the thing that I've seen with some of the biggest artists in the world, where they're not there to look at fashions. They're not there to follow fashions. They're there to just write music for themselves. And for me, that's where that you get the timelessness from the records, really.
Yeah, I feel so too.
I want to go back to when you first started DJing, because was production before DJing?
Absolutely.
Because you're known to be an exceptional DJ. And I've seen you play years ago, and you won't even remember meeting me, but in Ibiza a very long time ago. But I want to talk about how kind of that process started, and what it took to get to where you're at now.
Okay. Well, wait a second. So I met you?
Yeah, we met a very long time ago.
Was this without beard?
Pre-beard.
Pre-beard.
You were playing for Cream.
Amnesia.
Yeah. So I used to record a lot of DJ sets for Radio 1 and for a Polish radio station. And a guy called Tom Brown, I used to work for. And we would constantly, like, we'd come into Cream, mic up the club, and then record the sets from there. So we met multiple times, but I wouldn't expect you to remember me at all.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's not your fault.
Amazing. Legendary times.
Yeah.
The DJing part is interesting, because at a certain point, my first ex-wife was then my girlfriend. End of the 90s in the Netherlands, it was a trend for female DJs to come up and to get themselves out there. And she was inspired by this one female DJ. Shout out 100% Isis. You probably won't know her.
No,
but
I've never heard of her.
Shout out to her. She was influencing a lot of people. And so she had bought two decks and a mixer, two Sound Lab band vinyl players.
Belt-driven
players. So she, I had a, by this time I had my own record collection because of the tracks I had released. So she tried mixing a few tracks, and she got really frustrated with it. She couldn't do it. She thought it was way easier. She threw the pair of headphones in the side of the room. And for the next couple of weeks, I was looking at these turntables sitting there doing nothing. Catching and I was dust. Like, you know what? I'll just give it a shot. And so I started to mix, and I could instantly do it because I know music, I know intervals.
Yeah.
I understood that I needed to layer layer the beats. And so it was really quite easy for me. And then I started thinking, so if I'm making music for DJs, I should actually start knowing what a DJ desires for my tracks.
Yeah.
So I kind of started that, using it as a tool to enhance my productions. But then with everything I do, it's all or nothing. Mm. And so I wanted to, when I started DJing, I just wanted to know all the ins and outs of DJing, got myself some SLs, started listening to a lot of more technical DJs. So a lot of my my DJ skills come from listening to Jeff Mills and Dave Clark, guys like Frankie Bones. I started listening to them and the stuff they were doing, like the trickery and whatnot. I was like, this is like producing on the fly. Mm. So you mean to say that what I do in the studio, like chopping up beats or messing with the EQ, I can do all of this in DJ form as well.
Yeah.
And therefore I started to develop these DJ skills to be able to have that similar type of freedom. Mm. And it could, mind you, this was a longer process because only switching from the belt drives to the SLs, then to get the pitch technique right, took me at least 2 years.
Yeah.
I remember my girlfriend telling me, because I was listening to my own cassette tapes, my DJ mixes as practice. And sometimes we would listen to some type of radio show. And then I would sneak in one of my cassettes. And whenever she heard mistakes, she was like, is this you mixing this cassette? Is this your DJ mix? And I'm like, yeah, you got me. But I got better and better. And at a certain point, she couldn't even recognize me. So I got tighter. And then I started doing my tricks. And end of the 90s, I had started to make more and more techno. Mm. And my first global breakthrough, I need to talk about that, was my remix for Green Velvet, The Stalker.
Yeah, such a
cheat. Which coincidentally, I heard in a club, in a local club. I was dancing, I was out, I heard the original, and I heard that bass line. I was like, wow, that bass line is amazing, but I think the beats can use a bit more shuffle and a bit more energy. Like I wanted some sort of build up in there into a drop.
How good is that bass line? Sorry, but
yeah,
that bass line is so good.
It's massive.
Good. I love that record.
And I remember the week later I got the assignment to do the remix because Gaston, he had gotten the remix assignment and he said to the record label, hey, can we give this new talent that we have a shot? His name's Laidback Luke. You may not know him, but maybe he can do something with it. So I got the B side of it. They got the A side of it. The B side got played by Carl Cox, got picked up by Carl Cox, then Dave Angel, and then the whole of the techno community started playing it, and it just broke through.
Wow.
And thanks to that, I could DJ globally. Mind you, I had only been DJing for about a year in my bedroom.
Yeah.
I could start DJing globally. And I broke through as a techno DJ.
That's so dope. I didn't know you remixed that. I need to hear that remix. I've not heard it.
I think you might enjoy that. It's really dirty though. I was so much into like the dirty hi-hats type of sound. Yeah. Like at a certain point I started sampling my hi-hats on like lower bit rates just to get that crunch in there. And at a certain point in my development, I got really bored with the 909 sounds where I was like, man, I need to do something to it to make it sound less 909. And you'll hear that in that remix.
I'll check that one out. Definitely. So what year was that when you started DJing like worldwide?
1997. Got my first international gig in Reading in the UK.
World's
famous. Checkpoint Charlie. Shout out Checkpoint Charlie.
Was that the illegal raves?
No. This was legal. But I think one of my first shows was actually like either before or after Derek May.
Wow.
So no pressure.
Yeah, right? No pressure at all.
I remember getting on the stage and I was so nervous. I didn't anticipate that. My hands were shaking and I couldn't actually like hold the needle and the record. And I remember just with every track, I just threw the needle in the middle of the record and then just spun it back to try and get to the beginning of it.
Yeah, I love that. What was it like playing in those days?
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, the uncertainty of a needle skipping is terrible, and especially with all those bass frequencies. But there's an amazing sort of nostalgia in there also, where there were no LED screens. Mm. There was no CO2.
Yeah.
It was a smoky room with strobes.
Mm.
And yeah, it was glorious.
There's something amazing about that. And I feel like when we go back and play in a smaller venue with that's smoky and got strobes, again, it goes back to that nostalgia. And there's just something super special about that feeling. Do you ever get the chance to do that nowadays?
Not really. And I do need to, because yeah, and especially now, because you know, I've been in the commercial corner for such a long time, it's more of like a, my areas that I perform are like VIP clubs, yeah. And there needs to be CO2 and there needs to be the LED. But one of most of my all-time favorite parties were just like the basic ones where, yeah. I think the nostalgia is where instead of feeling like the conductor for the crowd, you become part of the crowd.
Totally.
And together you build that energy, and it's almost like as if you're on the dance floor with them.
No, I agree with you on that. So 1997, you said you started DJing worldwide. Was this a regular thing where it was every weekend, or was it sporadic?
Probably every month. But yeah, for me, this was a lot of traveling already.
Yeah. Go on, after you.
No, I had a good little international run those years after, yeah, until I landed back in the Netherlands career-wise.
Mm.
At a certain point, 1999, I broke through in the Netherlands at Awakenings Festival.
Yeah.
And then, I remember this. This is funny. I had a slot 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. in the morning. And me not having, I'm not, you know, a druggy party dude. I'm like a producer nerd. So I wasn't going to be about like going throughout the night. So I actually had set my alarm for like 5 a.m., had a bit of breakfast, then went out to the show, really fresh. 8 a.m. I remember playing after, must have been Umek or someone.
Yeah.
And I smashed the place. This is because I had been a loyal fan of Awakenings.
Yeah.
And I'd gone to their shows, and I was on that dance floor dancing, and I knew what that dance floor wanted.
Yeah.
So I decided at 8 a.m. I was going to give all that to them. And I did, and I had people climbing up on the fence to find out what my DJ name was.
Wow.
And when I ended, this was like, I'm still getting goosebumps. There was like a brand new talent had stood up. And I remember that week as well, I got approached by a famous Dutch booking agency, and they wanted to sign me. And from then on, I could play every weekend in the Netherlands. And it was from then on, I gave up my day job as a graphic designer and yeah, started my professional music career.
Amazing. And what year was that? 1999.
1999
to 2022 is a long career in music, and obviously there's many more years to go ahead of this. When was it that you started releasing on Size?
Oh, this was an awesome revolution, yeah, as well. So I do have to tell you why I parted with techno. And
tell me.
Because let me tell you, Will, I'm a big fan of what you are doing, what you are playing. I love your stuff. I buy your stuff, and whenever I get the chance, I play it.
Thank
And I always feel I need to explain to people why I left techno at a certain point, because I came up with Adam Beyer, mm-hmm. Umek, and Marco Carolla, like in about the same year all of us went global.
Yeah.
And so I was part of that crew. We would meet up. I still, you know, see Beyer on tour, and we always chat and whatnot. And it's, you know, from the outside, it's, okay, so why did this guy sell his soul for EDM music, and what happened? And the truth is, I was quite successful being an international techno DJ.
Yeah.
I had releases on amazing labels. I was doing it. But in the studio, the techno that I was playing was more of like a two-bar loop.
Yeah.
Going on and on to add right to add has to and coming from a musical family, so I'm half Dutch, half Filipino.
Yeah.
On my Filipino side, I also have a very musical family. But us Filipinos, and I'm really just speaking about all the Filipinos in the world, we love cheesy music. I figured this out. Finally, I figured this out. Whenever I'm in the Philippines, and other, you know, if there's anyone Filipino listening here, they can vouch for me. The biggest tracks in the Philippines are the sing-along ballads.
Yeah.
In a club, in a bar, sing-along ballads. Mm. Okay, so we have my European side, which loves techno.
Yeah.
And we have this cheesy side that's stuck in there, doing nothing. And so at a certain point, I wanted to have chords in my techno. I wanted to have vocals in my techno. I wanted to have big sing-along breakdowns. Mm. And I couldn't do it because it wasn't techno anymore.
Yeah.
And I kept on bumping into that in the studio, so much so that at a certain point, I gave myself a choice. Either I stop making music, or I will allow me to make any type of music that I want. And it was there that I parted from my techno career. And I had a few years of drought where I wasn't taking on any techno shows anymore. I didn't make a name for myself in the house realms yet. So this was tough. But I was happy in the studio because I was actually making electro synth pop from then on.
Wow.
Just I was grabbing the guitar again. I was programming drums, chord changes, and... yeah, I was just making songs.
Mm.
And I was so happy with that. And at a certain point, I found myself at the foundation of EDM.
Yeah.
And I started to do music with Steve Angelo in Sweden. Steve Angelo, who had been a fanboy of me, and sorry, this sounds like diminishing, but I say it with the highest respect.
Of
like
course.
He was a fanboy of myself because I had a forum. Mm. A forum online in the forum days where guys like Afrojack were on, Nicky Romero, Avicii. Steve Angelo was one of them. And he loved me because in 1999, I had made an official remix for Daft Punk.
Yep.
He loves Daft Punk. Swedish House Mafia loves Daft Punk still. I had done an official remix. And
which track did you remix?
As Crescendals.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, we started talking to each other, and Steve was like, dude, I would love to make music with you. He was exploding with his label, and his momentum was coming. And I was like, man, you know what? That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'll just go to Stockholm every year and make music with you guys. And started, you know, meeting the Swedish House Mafia and whatnot. When I saw Steve Angelo at work, the way his tracks were sounding was top tier loudness war at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no track, no producer, no dance music producer in the world that was getting that much low end frequency and that much loudness in their tracks.
Yeah.
Sitting next to him, watching him produce, I was like, that's how they did it. And I went back to the studio because at this time I was personally trying to make my own kick drums, my own hi-hats from scratch, every track. And what they did, they actually sampled a kick drum from like a big track.
Yeah.
And if you use that as your bass to build upon, your track will sound overall good.
Yeah, yeah.
Fat.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that saves so much time. And so I went from making one track in 2 or 3 weeks to making a track in 4 hours, sounding immense in the low end. And so I have to give a shout out to Steve Angelo and the Swedish House Mafia for revolutionizing my production techniques at that time. And yeah, I started releasing tracks on Size.
Yeah, that was also a very interesting time, because that we're talking like 2004, 2005 time, maybe 2006. I remember that coming, because that was when I was just starting producing. And there was a huge loudness battle on how to get your tracks to sound as loud as possible and still not distort or be sounding terrible. Which it must have been an amazing kind of era for you, from going from the analog days where everything was very kind of organic, I guess is the easiest word to describe, to then a very digital era where a lot of things are just done on plugins and just making things as in your face as possible. However, your early Size records, for me, I wouldn't have classed as EDM. I would personally it was kind of like a mixture between the blog house stage period and then house music. And I felt like it only got into the EDM a little bit later on. What was that period? What was your first release on Size? Was it
Killing the Kitchen, I believe.
Okay.
It was.
And what was your first big release that was like kind of got you to the point where you were like, okay, I'm back in this realm?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah, surely that was a B that I made together with Steve Angelo. That was massive, because I'd love to mention Breakdown the House, but Breakdown the House. So let me tell you the timeline. So I said after techno, I started making electro synth pop, and that it coincided with Fisher Spooner coming up, and all that like alternative band type of electro house that evolved into electro house, where Eric Prydz like really made his stamp using just like big synthy basses on the kick drum. And so where I was at, I still had those MK type of influences. With that type of influence, I made Breakdown the House. And I released it in like the electro house era. And it wasn't popular. None of these electro house DJs wanted to play it because it was way too housey. It had that Robin S. organ in there, had a weird bleep.
I used to play it all the time. I loved that record.
Oh, thanks, man.
I loved that record. It was amazing. I was listening through your old stuff earlier as well, and I forgot you made that record, but I played that so many times. It's great.
Hey,
it's
great. Nice. That's good to hear. So when all of this was happening internationally, I guess I got to mention the blog house, because I didn't realize that it was actually called that, but Switch was making moves in the Netherlands with a Solid Grooves track.
Yeah.
Solid Grooves tracks. And the whole of the Netherlands was getting housier and bleepier at that time. So I kind of fused the two and made break down the house, and no label wanted to sign it for a good 1.5 to 2 years while I was wrecking like festivals and clubs with it. And I, at a certain point, I was like, man, I'm just going to put it out on Mixmash on my own label. And finally, it made history because of that. But it was weird because it was completely against the grain. So from the blog house and the electro house, this slowly morphed into like what we know as EDM.
EDM,
now.
Yeah, definitely. When B came out, for me, that was like a pivotal moment in my career. Not for me personally, but musically. At that in that time, was it 2008?
Yes. Yeah.
How was that when that came out for you?
I still have goosebumps thinking of it. It was funny because I'll tell you the backstory, which was awesome. Like, so I had these annual annual meetups with the Swedish House Mafia in Stockholm, making music with them. So we were making tracks, and we had made, I think this was the same week as Leave the World Behind. So we had made Leave the World Behind, made another track with Ingrosso and Angelo. And at a certain point, both Axwell and Ingrosso said, well, we finished two massive tracks. We're going to go out and party, and we're going to, you know, get to a bar and get drunk. And Steve and I were, we were like, man, no, there's more here.
Yeah.
So I, what I brought to that session was, dude, you got to hear this track that's been played out in the Netherlands. It's called Debonair, Samir's anthem, Samir's theme. Mm. And the beat programming was boom, 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 boom. And Steve listened to it, and he's like, okay. So he programmed our kick drum like that. And this was also the same time, and this is where this where we go back full circle, the Korg M1 plug-in came out.
Yeah.
The synth where I was producing the whole summer on when I was 15 was there in plug-in form. And I was like, dude, the Robin S. organ is also in here.
Yeah.
Let's use it. And we made this melody. And Steve whipped up that Rowetta vocal. Shout out, Rowetta. Looped it.
I didn't know it was Rowetta.
Yeah.
I knew it was somebody similar, but I didn't know it was actually her.
Yeah, and I'll tell you more about Rowetta in a bit, but man, magic happened.
Yeah.
3.5 hours later, here's a fun fact. The organ, which I had programmed in my FL studio, bounced it to Steve Angelo's Logic, still has ticks in the beginning and in the end of the loop. And I was like, Steve, should we fix that? And he was like, nah, man, that's fine like that. And it was literally like 4 or 5 channels. But the magic, him and I were in the studio, and we're like, man, wow, incredible. So a slightly drunk Sebastian Ingrosso comes back to the studio after partied, and we let him hear B, and he was slapping himself in the forehead like, dude, I am not a part of this. Like, wait, can we, like, tweak some more? Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And Steve and I just ran with it. And amongst the first DJs that started playing that were Eric Morillo. Got to give a shout out to Mark Knight as well. And this was also a track that was not like in any popular sounding realms.
No,
this was something completely different, but it was a wrecker on the dance floor. Like, yeah, it works.
I was living in Ibiza at that time when it came out. And those were the years when you would have like Tunes of the Summer. And you'd go pretty much past every bar, every club, you would hear a record. And that year, that was one of the records. Was that the same year as Man with a Red Face, the Funk Agenda remix, Funk Agenda and Mark Knight?
Possibly.
Yeah, I think
possibly,
it was.
Yeah.
And
good times.
Yeah, man. The music then was, and I'm not saying it's bad now because music's great now, but that year was game changing.
Yeah, definitely hit different. Definitely hit different. Because what Steve and I were after, we weren't after like making the best streamable music because we didn't have Spotify yet. There was no Spotify. We were looking for like a a warmer and a housier feel, but something that would like really work on a dance floor. Like if you would be stood there on the dance floor, would you like dance to it? Would you go wild to it? Or would you be like, oh yeah, this is cool. Mm. And yeah, we were always looking for that ultimate dance floor feeling.
It's really interesting that you say that, that we weren't trying to make streamable music. It's really sad that we think like that.
Yeah. It's the algorithm that determines now, right?
To be fair. And I think maybe that is the reason why the music has changed a lot, because we're not actually, not, I can't speak for everybody, but I was talking to Alex from Dents and Pika yesterday about this actually, and he has like a side project. And he runs a record label called Hypercolor, which I'm sure you know, but also he has his Needed Pains on Dents and Pika. And we were talking about how he has a side project that he released a record, like an album on Hypercolor. And I was like, how did it do? And he's like, I don't know. He was like, I don't care. I literally wrote that music because I loved writing it, and I don't care about the streams. I don't care about the sales. It's just great music, and I'm happy for it. And I was like, that's such an, like a refreshing mindset to have. And I said, are you the same with Dents and Pika? He was like, no, completely opposite. He was like, when we're looking at the Dents and Pika stuff, we're tracking it and we're worrying about it. And he was like, it changes the music. When was the track? I want to go back to your old stuff, but this is like, we're kind of going on a tangent, but when was it for you where you were like, I have to make music that streams well and it does successfully?
Well, it also has to do with running a record label, my Mix Mash record label. Yeah. It's just very simple. To keep a label running, you need to have sales.
Yeah.
Back then it was vinyls, CDs, and then the amount of Beatport sales, and that became, you know, streaming. And so, yeah, sometimes tracks don't do well instantly, and it's worrisome. But then for me, there's always a hope, because, you know, a track like Break Down the House didn't do anything at first. Even Leave the World Behind, we never got, like, we entered the top 40 in the UK, I think, but it never went, like, top 30. But then years go by, and friends tell friends, and they tell other friends, and then all of a sudden it's a classic, and I love that. I've had that with so many of my tracks, and it's sometimes feels like there's no room for that anymore. It needs to be an immediate result, or else it's nothing.
You have 2 weeks now, for the record to get playlisted by the playlist gods at Spotify, and if it doesn't get playlisted within at least a month, it's almost game over on your record. Unless, like, my last record that did really well was a record called Rock With Me. And I say well, it did well for me, not on your numbers, but it's on Patrick Toppin's label Trick. And it came out and it did like 250,000 streams, which we were just like, okay, we didn't expect it to do anything. Right. So it did what it did. And then all of a sudden it got put to number one on Techno Bunker. And I think today it's literally just hit 3 million.
Whoa.
And for like a techno record that's like I literally made in 2 hours, it's pretty amazing. But it just goes to show that it's just purely, there's none of that slowly growing a record. It's whether it gets put on a playlist, and if it doesn't, and it doesn't get put in the top 10 of the playlist, it's just on to the next. And that record's kind of lost into the habisk of music, which is really sad to me, if I'm honest.
Well, you know where I am right now, Will? Right now, I don't even care about the success of a record anymore.
Wow. Like,
'cause I've had a couple of big peaks over the last couple of years. Mm. And because you're always on to the next, like either no expectations ever.
Yeah.
So if it peaks, it's like, yeah, whatever. I'm already in my new project. or if it doesn't, nothing. You're like, whatever, I'm in my new project. Mm. And I do just want to emphasize that this has to do with a certain artistic mental health thing where, you know, if I start worrying about these things, I can't make music. Mm. Where I feel the real gold in music is in the actual process of making the track, where you are in the studio and you're thinking, whoa, this is amazing. I'm really enjoying this right now. If only I could see it on a dance floor, or you're even dancing in the studio. Anything that happens after that should be whatever.
Yeah.
Because it'll only affect you like either positively or mentally, but it does something to you. Mm. Whereas it doesn't matter how successful, rich, famous, unrich, not famous at all you are, this magic in the studio will always be yours. And that's what I'm focusing on nowadays.
That's beautiful. What was the process to get to that? Because I know that feeling. And I feel like most people that have produced records, or most people that have achieved something that they're passionate about, anyone has a passion, there is that feeling there somewhere, whether that's singing, songwriting, producing, drawing, graffiti, like anything to do with the creative side of things. But how did you get to that process where you're at now?
Well, at first, we need to realize that whenever you're a creative person and that whenever you create, it can be affected by the world. Mm. And when it gets affected by the world, it'll tamper with your artistry. Mm. What the beauty is of our artistry is that we can literally be sitting somewhere, come up with something, and then actually create that something and give it out to the world. That's amazing. From nothing, just by thought, giving a piece of memory, or, you know, there's plenty of those messages out there where it's like, you know, your track did this or that to me, or holds, well, like you just said, your Summer in Ibiza is linked to one of my tracks.
Yeah.
Dude, that's magic.
Yeah.
And that is what it's all about, really. And if you start focusing on the numbers and you're not streaming well, and you just get tampered with mentally.
No,
it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, I feel you. I'm in that position right now, if I'm honest. It's like, it's that the pressure of wanting more for my career, and then trying to translate that in the studio, and it just doesn't work. it goes to shit because you're in it for the doing it for the wrong reasons, rather than no worries.
Let me talk to you about your first big track.
Okay,
which was the track that put Will Clark on the map?
There was two. I had kind of two moments where, I don't know, I guess my first ever one was a track called Booty Percolating,
nice.
Which came out on Worthy's label, Anabatic. I believe it came out in 2014. And that was the first record where other DJs were playing it.
And so we have two tracks that mean something to us that have the title Booty.
Yeah, that's why I laughed. and that wasn't when my career started at all. That was just when I kind of got my first inroad of people supporting my records. But then I quit 6 months after. I'd stopped music for 6 months because I was so Jamie Jones was playing my records. Jamie Jones, Seth Troxler, the Martinez brothers, Eats Everything. And they were like gods at the time. It was like when they were kind of really blowing up. MK was playing it as well. And I was in talks with Jamie, and Jamie was like, yeah, I'd love an EP for Hot Creations. And I was like, okay, I need to make Hot Creations music now. And you're shaking your head because you know exactly that process where I was trying to write music for Hot Creations, and I didn't write Hot Creations music. I wrote Will Clark music, and Booty Percolating. No, Booty, Big Booty was a Will Clark record. It wasn't anything else. It definitely wasn't a Hot Creations record. And the reason why everyone was playing it was because it didn't sound like everything else. But I didn't understand that at the time, and I hadn't been through that process. So yeah, I quit for 6 months, and yeah, then the rest is history. But I think my first big record that really, really moved the needle for me, and I started touring, was 2 years later, which is actually another Booty record called Booty Percolating, and that came out on Dirty Bird. And from then on, I was touring full time.
Wow, on Dirty Bird. So it's funny because I have you in this whole like techno bracket, but yeah, actually your successes were more in the housey and tech house, deep house realms. Wow.
So Dirty Bird was the reason. Dirty Bird was the first label that I would class as like my home in music at that time. And then in the last 3 to 4 years, I kind of moved directions and then kind of moved into the more techno area, which for me is like I wasn't really into techno when I was younger. I was into like soulful house with like Defected, at Strictly Rhythm as well, and that was kind of where I first started. But yeah, and now I'm obviously doing my own label. So
fascinating. So I think we're onto something here, Will, because I had recently made a vlog about what happens after your first success.
Yeah.
And what not a lot of people know, that more often than not, after your big success, you come into like a big dip, because massive, there's supposed to be this follow-up. And no one is really pressuring you other than yourself saying, we need a follow-up, or what's next? And that is, so I was shaking my head indeed, because that's heavy. So that coincided for me with my first burnout ever at the age of 20.
I couldn't make
a follow-up.
Yeah.
And mind you, I was always that guy that used to say, burnouts aren't real. Like you guys just got to man up. And it's, and then I got hit by one myself, and I was like, oh, okay, now I understand.
Yeah.
But the pressure of a follow-up is terrible. So then the magic formula should be going back to that mindset as how, when you made Booty Percolating or your first booty track, that sort of possibly playfulness, non-pressure, like I'm just going to make awesome music or whatever, like something that I'm feeling in the studio right now.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. You're 100% right. I think for me as well, though, and I'm not too sure if you've been through this as during your career, which I'm sure you have. I want to create a different sound to what I've been making in over the last like 2-3 years, and kind of evolve. And that's the thing where I'm like, it's very easy to go in the studio and just replicate what you've made over the years. Because it's kind of like that muscle memory. But I think the hard thing for me is going in and actually creating that something that I haven't created before, and using different sounds that I haven't used before, and just enjoying that process of what we all went through when we were kids and initially started producing. It's definitely a process, and talking to you actually is really, really helpful, because it just brings back that kind of the magic feeling of what it should be, and rather than what it shouldn't be as well. When I want to go back to after B came out, because I can imagine that being pretty life changing.
Yes. Well, it got taken up a notch as well when Hardwell made the bootleg between B and Mobin Masters, Show Me Love.
Yeah.
Like he put the two together. And I remember I had actually come out of like a new session in Stockholm with the Swedes. And I had just, I was booked for a show in Sweden at the end of the week. And I remember Hardwell sending that to me. I was like listening, like 2 days before the show, I was listening to it. And I was like, wow, I think this can work. Like, yeah. Okay, I can see that on the dance floor. And mind you, so I got to give a shout out to Stonebridge, who was the original man that remixed Robin S. is Show Me Love. Yeah. That's the classic of all classics. But he's from Sweden.
Yeah.
And so in Sweden, this is a massive track.
Banger,
this is like folklore almost, right?
When was that? 93 that came out, I think?
92.
92, wow.
And so I played it out in Stockholm at the end of the week. And my God, the whole place erupted. I had the Swedes running into my booth, like asking me what this mashup was and what was going on. And people were just losing it. I was like, okay, so this was successful. Let's try it on different shows.
Yeah.
And the following 2 years, I wrecked every festival and every show with that track. Mm. Obviously, it spread to all the other DJs. Everyone was playing it.
Everyone.
2 years later, Steve and I looked at each other and we were like, dude, because it's a mashup, right?
Yeah.
It didn't really exist. And we were looking at each other. We were like, man, we got to make this an official version.
Mm.
It's so successful on the floors. Let's just, you know, this needs to be put out officially. And so then we brought in Rowetta to do the first part.
Yeah.
And it was amazing working with such a legend, recording her vocal. And then we had the real Robin S. re-sing her own vocals on the version as well.
Amazing.
And it's crazy.
Yeah.
That's and special. So, yeah, that was absolutely a huge highlight for my career, for sure.
So what, I want to talk about the highs and the lows of that. Let's start with the highs. When that came out, you were obviously touring full time and touring a lot as it was. What changed?
Yeah, actually, I need to talk to you about a few highs and lows in my career, if we can sneak that in, because
this is
very valuable, actually. So my first high, obviously after the Green Velvet Stalker remix, launched my techno career. At a certain point, I couldn't make techno anymore. I wanted to stop making music. So out of that, I started to make all the music that I desired and wanted to make. In 2003, I had a number one top 40 hit in the Netherlands with the Dance Valley Festival, which was the biggest festival in the Netherlands. I made the theme song.
Yeah.
I ended up being number one over Justin Bieber and over anyone else. In the Netherlands, I had made it. All of a sudden, I was, because I had a video, I was like a TV personality.
Yeah.
I did it. I was there. 2004 comes around, and I had just only been enjoying my fortune and fame in the Netherlands, been doing nothing else but like not releasing music or anything. 2004 comes around, no one wants to do with me because I was commercial, I wasn't putting out any music, no one was asking me for a remix.
Yeah.
I had nothing at the end of 2004, super dip. Then my next revolution came when I started producing with Steve Angelo. So I had to go international, I had to go out of the country. And so this was a long peak, kind of like working towards 2010. I was one of the people that brought the typical Dutch sound out of the Netherlands, linking David Guetta with people like Afrojack, pushing Afrojack. Guys like Chucky and I, we came up, we were pushing this bleepy Dutch sound.
Mm.
This was a nice peak. And from that, like gradual, very gradual peak, I've been coming down ever since, what was it, 2013, to where I'm at now, where it's like none of the EDM guys get booked, really. We don't really get much playlists. EDM is gone. And now I'm here again. And here is kind of like where a new start begins unfolding for me. And I'm actually really happy with it. Obviously, all of us had COVID and had time to rethink careers and whatnot. But I feel like I'm not at like a low, but I'm definitely at a point where if this is 2009, I'm currently here.
Yeah.
But I'm getting ready to get back up again for sure.
I think it's really important to kind of for people to hear that though, because there's never a career that's up all the time. Never. And you may look at some of the biggest artists in the world right now, they've not always been at the top, and they won't always be at the top. They will have peaks and troughs, and I think it's super normal to have that. It's healthy to have that because it means that we evolve as artists and as human beings, mostly. When was the point when you realized I'm at the peak?
The moment I realized that was last year when I looked back at my career.
Yeah.
And this is the point where I had decided to make more timeless music because I have this radio show on Tomorrowland Radio, which is called Way Back Luke. Mm-hmm. It started with me making a tribute for Avicii.
Yeah.
And then Tomorrowland was why don't you make a tribute to the DJs you have history with and whom you know? So I've been doing that every month. And then at a certain point, Tomorrowland wanted me to make an episode about me. And in that episode, we would go from my beginning music to like my peak and to where I'm at now. And I was like, man, now I see the bigger scope. Yeah. Listening to that show myself, I got the most goosebumps listening to tracks like Turbulence and B versus Show Me Love. And I was like, man, that was massive indeed. And only now when I look back at the pictures and the tremendous amount of touring, I realize I was at a peak. But being right in the middle of it, I was like, this is my reality. This is normal. Like, okay, I'm at Coachella right now in 2012. And, oh, hey, there's Usher backstage. And I remember Diplo hitting me up that we needed to make a track with Beyonce. And I thought he was joking. And so I never followed that up. But he was real about it. I remember coming to Madonna's house because she wanted to make an album with me. And she is sorry for flexing, but I'm just like,
no, people need to hear this.
And I came to her house and had a really good conversation with her. And at a certain point I was like, how did you find me? Mind you, this was 2013, 2014. And she was like, well, whenever I'm working out and I say, whose track is this? My personal trainer says, this is a guy called Laid Back Luke. And she was just like, well, let's have you over. And to me at that time, all of that was normal.
Yeah.
Like it just becomes your reality. Mm. And now looking back where I'm like more here, I'm like, man, those times were incredible. And mind you, I'm not done at all. I'm getting ready for the next wave.
Yeah.
But next time I do want to bring more of that awareness in. And what I love that us DJs are doing momentarily is look out for each other's mental health. Mm. Obviously, this sprouted enormously with the passing away of Avicii.
Yeah.
And we've had more DJs passing away after that.
Yeah.
And so I feel it's a really nice conversation nowadays, even when you see someone peaking right now, to just be able to look at that and to reach out and to talk about it. Because what does it really mean? What does it really do with you as a human? What does it do with your family life, your real life? What does it do with spending money and materialistic things? And there's so many facets to this.
What does it do? Because you've been there. What does it do? And I think it's like, what are those things when you're at that peak, when you're in Madonna's house, when you're earning extremely good money? Because that was the era when DJs became rock stars. There wasn't rock bands around. It was DJs. And it was when Swedish House Mafia came out, when you got to the level where you got to, when Avicii kind of came out at that time, maybe a little bit after, Afrojack, all of those guys and girls turned into rock stars. What was it like?
I remember telling everyone, we won over hip hop.
Yeah.
We did it. And it was massive, absolutely massive. What it does to you if you don't watch out is you get. So I got to give a shout out to my Kung Fu teacher because he always says,
I was going to ask you about this.
My Kung Fu teacher says, don't believe your hype.
Yeah.
As soon as you start believing your own hype, that's your downfall. Mm. You're going to, because you'll think you're the shit. Mm. And that always comes with repercussions, whereas like, yeah, people will let you down, you'll let yourself down, you'll break relationships. The materialistic stuff as well. I remember spending money and not valuing money anymore because I had such a high amount of it. Yeah. Like regular cost would be only a percentage, like a small percentage. And people with a normal job would say, oh, how could you spend this on that?
Yeah.
And mind you, I'm not a flashy guy, but I did have bizarre spendings at a certain point. But it just becomes a percentage of what you're making. And so not as painful as it should be. Yeah. And now when I'm here and the money is, I'm right here right now. Yeah. I'm back. And now I'm like, oh, okay. Now I get it. Now I understand. And I'm actually thankful I'm not here anymore because you can only spend money once.
Yeah.
And it's actually not the money that makes you happy, right? It's the quality of time. Mm. It's the overall happiness you experience from it. If you're just buying stuff to try and make you fill in that gap of happiness, that's not where it's at. Yeah. So I'm thankful to have learned these lessons throughout.
I heard a great saying yesterday on a podcast. It's a Lex Fridman podcast. And he said, money is a great servant, but a terrible master. And I literally, like, I live a great life and I earn reasonably good money, but I'm nowhere near at the point where you guys were at financially. And I can see it affect people massively, not just in music, in life. And that saying really hit home to me, because it's like when you're just chasing the money, I can only speak for myself, but it's very easy to just get lost in chasing the money and want more and actually forget about what we actually do it for and why we do it. And don't get me wrong, the business side of this industry is huge and we have to earn money to pay our rent and pay our bills and pay for our kids and do all of that. But there's still an element where we have to enjoy the process. And I think when you just chase, that enjoyment goes out.
Yeah, you know what? Let me share this with you. Science has shown that any amount you make over $70,000 a year does not add up to your happiness, to your overall happiness. Sure, there's things that you can buy, but over $70,000 does not add up.
Yeah.
So if you're everyone who's listening right now and who's making music and is able to earn about $70,000 per year from music, don't look any further. You know, whatever happens, happens. And, you know, if there's a track out there that you made out of fun, out of enjoyment, and the rest of the world shares that with you, that's wonderful. Mm. But there's actually no pressure.
Yeah.
So there is a certain pressure in a society where they're like, yeah, you got to make money, you got to earn, you got to milk it. And actually, that's fake. That's not even a necessity. Like, it'll be nice, but indeed, don't make money your master, because it just messes with you.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's that battle that I feel like we all take to a certain extent, because I think a lot of it isn't about wanting the money. It's about wanting the success and wanting our records to be heard by multiple millions of people all around the world. But what comes with that is the money. And what comes with that is the success and the egos and the kind of being put on pedestals. I want to speak to you about I did some research on you and it came up with your Kung Fu, and I'm not too sure how true any of the stories were, but it kind of mentioned about you drinking and becoming sober and then taking up Kung Fu on a serious basis. Is any of that true? And also, can you kind of tell me about it a little bit?
Absolutely. It's no secret. By now I had 3 burnouts in my life, but my second burnout coincided with me drinking heavily during every show. Mind you, this was around my 30th. And, yeah, something horrible had happened, an incident with my son, which was my fault, where he ended up having a bleeding face because of me losing my temper because of a hangover.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I quit cold turkey.
Mm.
And then I was still wrestling with my burnout, and then my Kung Fu teacher said, and mind you, I'd already been doing Kung Fu for a decade.
Yeah.
He said, we needed to take your Kung Fu up a notch.
Yeah.
And so you can handle this tremendous touring that you are doing. And yeah. I was like, man, I can't take on anything else. Like, I'm spending all of my time trying to make music, trying to uphold my career and touring. How am I gonna supposed to like take up Kung Fu on like a higher level right now? And he's like, you know what, we'll just do it. Started yeah. taking him on tour with me, and he leveled me up, and he mm-hmm. leveled me up that much that at a certain point while touring, I remember Miami Music Week, because he took me out to the World Championships, my teacher, and I remember Miami Music Week, I was waking up at like 5 a.m. in the morning to train Kung Fu in my balcony, because the next week after, I would have the World Championships in Hong Kong. I also remember in Ibiza, I was a guest for Dimitri Vegas and Like Mike, and the Tomorrowland crew yeah. loves a bit of a drink. And I said, no, I can't, because literally like next week I had my second World Championships. And I was training out in the grass in the morning, and it Amazing. Just kept me so level-headed and focused. And yeah, in the end, my Kung Fu teacher made me a Kung Fu teacher. So I'm teaching people globally, a certified teacher.
Mm, and that's amazing.
It's amazing how it has helped me deal with stress and pressure. And yeah, just staying level-headed, staying zen.
What do you think would have happened if you didn't take him on tour and you didn't kind of look at your drinking side of look at your life, really, and take a look in the mirror?
I would probably look 15 years older now,
yeah.
and I would have done many stupid things.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, Yeah, I do believe that I've had a positive influence on people throughout because of my Kung Fu.
Amazing. I love that. I've not done this on the podcast before, but I'm going to start doing this more often and kind of asking a question towards the end of... I'm going to kind of keep the same question going. It's a very generic question, but I don't kind of want it to be a generic question. I want it to be for generally not just music. I want it to be people all in the world, for anybody that's kind of living. And what is I want people to get some advice from everybody on these podcasts and kind of take away that like the last bit of kind of gold on this podcast. And I guess the question is what one bit of advice would you give to somebody to live a happy life?
And let me think, because the answer might seem easy,
yeah.
but the execution is not.
And I think it changes. If I was asked this today, and then I'm asked this in a week's time, it's going to change.
Yeah,
and this is why I love this question, and I've been thinking about trying to do this more and more on the podcast, and just give. And it's going to be. I'm really interested to see what people come up with.
What I see coming back a lot around me nowadays is insecurities about oneself taking over, where the interpretation of the world means so much to one person that it affects their happiness.
Mm.
So you say I'm talking to you, Will.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can think about is how you are judging me
mm-hmm.
in a negative way.
Yeah.
And And I keep on thinking that. Mm. And you might just sit there and be like, dude, I have a ton of respect for you.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that, and it'll affect my happiness, where if I can find solace in, well, whatever you think of me, it doesn't actually matter to me.
Yeah.
Like, it shouldn't affect my happiness. Yeah. So however you think of me, good or bad, shouldn't affect my entity, my little universe that I am. Mm. If you can empower yourself with that, and I don't mean you to become cocky or anything, but just to shield yourself from outer anxiety and outer stress. You are the way you are. Mm-hmm. We're a multiverse. You're the Will Clark universe. I'm the laid-back Luke universe.
Yeah.
And we can exist.
Totally.
You can exist in your own way, and I can exist in your own way, and have peace with it. I don't need to be Will Clark. I could never grow a beard like that. And I'm jealous of that beard.
Yeah.
But hey, that looks good in your on your universe.
Yeah.
And I should just be happy with the fact that I don't grow a beard. Mm. And, you know, I feel that's a point that's been reoccurring around me that a lot of people miss out on, and it affects people so badly.
Yeah.
Say, well, if I WhatsApp you tomorrow and you don't respond, where I would go in my mind is, oh, Will must hate me. Like, yeah. we've had this conversation, and he's not interested anymore, whatever. Yeah. Or I could think he must be busy, like he's editing the show, or, you know, he's talking to a new person that he wants to interview.
Yeah.
So reality can mess with you a little bit.
100%.
And this stems out of a certain insecurity that's deeply rooted in people.
Mm, I love that. Luke, it's been an absolute honor to speak to you, man. I really, really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed this. I feel like we could keep going. We've done an hour and a half, and it feels like it's been 10 minutes. I'd love to pick this up again another day, hopefully in person, and we can do an even longer one. Before we get going, I say this, but everyone's heard of you. But if anybody hasn't heard of you or aren't following you, how can they follow you and how can they kind of keep in touch with what you're getting up to?
Well, I would recommend if you like this type of, conversation, like online presence, definitely go check out my YouTube channel.
Amazing.
So it's just Laid Back Luke. I make vlogs. I talk about mental health. I sometimes take you backstage touring. Check it out. It might be fun.
Amazing. Thanks so much, dude. I really appreciate it. And hopefully I'll see you soon.
Thank you, Will. Thanks, Thank you, man, for having me.
Wow, that was amazing. Love that conversation. Hope you did. Please share it with your friends. Please give us some reviews. And please subscribe. Keep safe. See you next time.
What if you could have a career where the opportunities are as vast as our nation? Where it's not about mission statements, but a shared mission. At U.S. Customs and Border Protection, we go beyond to protect more than borders. From ship to shore, air to ground, cities to local communities, CBP agents and officers are keeping people safe. Join U.S. Customs and Border Protection and go beyond for something far greater than yourself. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.